Okay, that's an epic movie called The A Southern Yankee. But you know, really, what a great illustration of what it actually, when you try to please both God and man, that eventually just a shift in the wind kind of exposes the folly of that and just leads into disaster. And so when we come to the book of Esther, and now we're going to start seeing in Esther chapter 2, she is kind of walking that line between being a Jew and in the Persian court. And so we're going to learn from her life and in chapter 2, and hopefully take something away from what it means to live in this world but not be of this world. So if you have your Bibles, I'd like you to open up to Esther, chapter 2, verses 1 through 18. I'm just going to read through this passage, make a few comments, and then we'll kind of wrap this up. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Now, from chapter 1 to chapter 2 has been several years. King Ahasuerus, now if you have the NIV, it says Xerxes, and some other translations says Xerxes. The Hebrew words that's being used is Ahasuerus here, but it is talking about King Xerxes. King Xerxes has been gone. Remember last week he was trying to get people rallied up to go to war against Greece, and that's all that he did. He went to war, beat the Spartans, took a lot of effort to beat the Spartans, but as he continued on, he really had humiliating defeats against Greece overall and finally ended with a naval defeat. So now he's back. He's battered, he's bruised, and he's back. And so he's here and he remembered Vashti. And the word remembered here can carry an idea of regret. So he's thinking about her and thinking what had done and that he had sent her away. You know, she's not there to comfort him as he comes back. So there could be some of that at play, but you know it's kind of a miserable scene for Ahasuerus, Xerxes. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Well, we know the solution here. Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. What you need is some new women in your life." And then they go on and says, "And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to a harem, to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them." You know, make them even prettier. You know, get these pretty virgins, make it a little prettier, and let the young women who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. Well, this pleased the king, and that's what he did. And what they're asking for, and what you see, is that, you know, here he is, he's miserable, they're going to gather all these women up, and they're going to have, you know, we usually say it's like a beauty contest. It's not like the beauty contest that we have. Basically, what they were going to have, and just quite frankly, is one-night stands with the king, and whoever pleases him the most will get to be the queen. And it goes on in verse 5. "Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away." Now, first of all, just know that Mordecai probably wasn't the one that was actually carried away. He would be over 100 years old at this time. But it's probably referring, and they're telling you the people that were carried away. Kish was the one that was carried away, but he was carried away because his ancestors had carried away. But he's a part of the captives there. He's a foreigner in a foreign land. He's a Jew, not a Persian. And then we learn that he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at, and when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So here is Mordecai, her cousin, that's taken over, raising her. And we're introduced to Esther. But we're introduced by two names. One is Hadassah, which is the Hebrew word for fragrance, literally myrtle. You know, so when you see the word Hadassah, it actually means myrtle, but it also carries the idea of fragrance. It would have been a whole different book if it was the book of Myrtle. You know, Queen Myrtle doesn't quite have the same ring to it, does it? And Esther is a Persian name that means for star. Some might think it's also a Hebrew reference to Ishtar, the goddess of war, but we're not thinking that. I think it really is probably means Persian for star. And in the book of Esther, she's the only person given two names. She's given her Hebrew name and she's given her Persian name. And it's a reminder that here this girl is, who might be 14, 16, maybe at the most 18 years old, is living in a foreign land. She's a Jew, but yet she's a part of the Persian culture. So we kind of get this idea that she's living in the midst of these two worlds. And so we also see that she's an orphan here, that she lost her parents, and her cousin Mordecai is raising her. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel in custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Hegai, who had charge of the women, and the young women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. So here we're seeing that these women are being gathered. There is no really sense that they are doing this by force. Could be some force. It probably is more like in Cinderella when the ball was given and all the women wanted to come, that maybe they might become the queen of the prince, you know, the princess for the prince, and then eventually queen in the empire. But Esther's a part of this. Whether it's by compulsion or by volunteer, she is now a part of this. And when she arrives, the man that's in charge of all these women, hundreds and hundreds of these virgins that are there, took special note of her. There's something different about Esther. There's something different about this woman. And she became one of his favorites. And he goes on, and he quickly provided her, Esther, with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with seven chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. So here he's given her cosmetics to make her prettier. He's given her good food. He's given her, you know, attendants, and he's given her the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. Now, this is really an interesting verse because a lot of people, we don't know why Mordecai would have her do this. Why would Mordecai tell her, well, don't tell anybody that you're a Jew? The Persians were not really that hostile towards the Jewish people. Some would be later, and we'll see. But they weren't that hostile towards them. They had a variety of people that were in there. But Mordecai, for one reason or another, told her not to share that she was that. And I do think there is a little bit of concern in him for her safety about that, because it says in the next verse, and every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. So he was constantly concerned, making sure that things were going okay. Then in verse 12, now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under regulations for women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for the women. So not only were they pretty, okay, get this, you know, so here's the king. He's getting all these pretty virgins together, but before he sees them, they need to go through some beautiful beautifying treatments for 12 months. You know, because they got to really be at their best. So, you know, they have myrrh that's smeared on them for 6 months, and then they have these ointments that are put on them for 6 months. You know, they have the cosmetics. I mean, they're done up. They've had their glamour shots. Oh, no, it wouldn't be glamour shots. Glamour paintings. You know, whatever it is, you know, everything is just done right. Their hair is right. And then they're allowed to take whatever they want to go in. It says this, when the young women went in to the king, in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. So she was given whatever she thought, that she's got one night to spend with this guy, and if she wants him to pick her as king and or queen, then she's got to really be pleasing him and bring whatever she thinks is going to convince him. So that's what's going on here. And then in verse 15, it goes on and says, and when the turn for Esther, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter to go into the king, she asked for nothing except for what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who had charged other women, advised. So now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her, including the other women in the thing. They just saw something different about her. Maybe it was because of Mordecai bringing her up. We don't know that Mordecai was married. There's no mention of a family. And here's a cousin. You know, he gets this young girl trying to figure out how to raise her. Maybe that's part of it. We don't know. But there's something about Esther that just stands out. Instead of deciding for herself what to take in, she asks Hegai, who knows the king, says, okay, what do you think I should take? What should I bring in? And so that's what she does. And when Esther was taken to the king and taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight, more than all the other virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So whatever happened during that night, he fell in love with her and made her his queen. Then the king gave a great feast for all of his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. So he threw a big celebration. He wanted the people to love her like he loved her. And how do you get people to love somebody? You reduce their taxes, right? We like politicians who do that, right? So here, you know, he reduces taxes, and then they, you know, in the name of Esther, and everybody's like, well, we like this Esther. And so we have the beginning of Queen Esther. Now, I want to talk about this a little bit, because there's some things that are troubling here about Esther. Now, last week we talked about that Mordecai and Esther, really early on in the pages, really don't come up off as pious Jews. They're hiding their identity. There is no reference to God. There's no reference to miracles. There's no longing for Jerusalem. And here Esther is part of this beauty pageant to become the bride of a pagan king, which the Word of God clearly says not to do this, not to marry somebody outside of the faith, not to marry somebody who is not an Israelite. So there is some issues here. Rabbis have struggled with it. Christian writers have struggled with it. That she's actually doing something that she should not be doing. And we don't fully understand why. So a word of caution about this account, and what we need to remember, first of all, it's just an account. It's just telling us what happened. The Bible tells us stories and accounts and narratives, historical narratives, about all kinds of people that we're not supposed to say, okay, I need to be just like that person. Samson really made a mess of his life. We shouldn't just say we're going to be like Samson. King David, there's some great things about King David that we would say that we would be like him, but King David did some terrible things that we don't want to imitate. So what we have here is really a very complex story about Esther and Mordecai in this place. And it's kind of nice to have this complexity, because life is a little complex. Have you noticed that? That life can be really kind of difficult to figure out at times. And there's times that we know what's right and we're like, oh, I just don't know that I'm strong enough, I'm courageous enough to do what is right. I think this is the beauty of Esther. I mean, and really, this book is way different than with some of the ways that we teach it in Sunday school and children. And, you know, it's a very complex account of what happened in Persia during Xerxes' rule. So while we can say she really kind of violated some things of Scripture and there's some things that were at stake here, I would also say don't be too critical. Because remember, she's in a foreign land. She's captive. She's in exile. She's never knew the temple. She's never known her homeland. She's also an orphan. Her parents died probably when she was just a little girl. You almost get the sense that maybe they died at the same time. And then she's being raised by her cousin Mordecai, who wasn't probably that old either. And Mordecai is giving her direction, and she's being obedient to what he's telling her, like she's supposed to be. I think there's got to be fear, because Xerxes, scary guy. Though they're very civil for this time and place, the Persians more civil than a lot of places, still he is a warrior king. And here she is, maybe 14, 16, 18 years old, and is swept up in the politics of really the Persian Empire. Do you think there would be some cause to be fearful at this time? So I think we should understand that part. But then the other side is, don't be too accommodating. Don't be willing to excuse her too much. Because there is these three guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who wouldn't bow down to this golden image, and they got in trouble for it in Babylon. And they didn't eat the food that they were supposed to eat. They ate their food that they knew that was wholesome and according to their biblical mandate. And so when they were threatened to be put in the fiery furnace by Nebuchadnezzar, this is what the account says in Daniel 3:16-18. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God that we serve is able to deliver us from it. And he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of God of the gold you have set up." And the story, if you're familiar with it, they were thrown into the fiery furnace and they did not burn up. And then the angel of the Lord, which we believe is the pre-incarnation of Jesus Christ, shows up in that furnace with them, and Nebuchadnezzar is amazed. And so a lot of times what we might say is, Esther was fearful and, fearing for her life. Yes, she probably was. And then, if she stood up and said she was a Jew and she wasn't going to do that, maybe she would die. Well, maybe, maybe not, but there is a God who would deliver her. So we don't want to be too accommodating. We just want to see Esther for what it is. It is an account of what this young woman was going through. And I'm pretty sure if we had a book in the Bible, wouldn't that be a nightmare for us? I mean, if we had a book in the Bible, so there would be things in there we would go, "Yeah, I did that." Right? So what we want to do is take a look at her and say, well, what does that mean to us? Well, I think what we learn here are some lessons regarding being in the world but not of the world. And it's a reminder when we look at her life and what's being and how she's being torn in these two different areas, that we are called to be in the world but not of the world. Now, there is no Bible verse that actually says be in the world and not of the world exactly. But there's some verses that come really close. When Jesus is talking to his disciples, he says this: if you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. So if you're not part of the world's system, the world isn't going to like you. In John chapter 17, verse 14 through 16, Jesus is praying to the Father, and he says, "I have given them, his followers, for all time, I've given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one." So we get this sense of being not of the world, but still in the world. In this verse, they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. So our pattern here is we see Jesus. We see Jesus was in the world, but he was not of the world. 1 John chapter 2, verse 17 says, "Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father he is not in them." 1 Corinthians 5, verse 9 and 10, I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people. Well, that seems pretty self and straightforward. But then he has to add a caveat. Not at all meaning the people of this world who are immoral and greedy and swindlers or idolaters. In that case, you'd have to leave this world. You'd have to leave the planet. And what he's saying there is the immoral people, sexually immoral people in the church who say they're Christ followers, don't associate with them. I'm not saying don't associate with the world because you really got to be out there because immorality is everywhere. You would have to leave the planet. You'd have to be like that movie The Martian and be the only one on Mars, and there still would be a sinner there. James chapter 1, verse 27 says, religion that God our Father accepts is pure and faultless in this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. So that is what it's talking about, how we're being influenced. So in my study at coming and looking at this part of the idea of being in the world and of, not of the world, I came across a website that is called Cold Case Christianity. You'll see a little reference there. This is a police detective who specializes in cold cases, who was this radical, angry atheist. And what he would, and what he decided to do was to start disproving Christianity, which I love stories like that because I hear a lot of them. And now he's an apologist for Christianity because he couldn't disprove it. And so he wrote a little bit about what it means to be in the world and not of the world. And I kind of like what he says because he was talking about he and his wife were watching a show on one of their favorite shows on the computer, and there were some things that they were just becoming uncomfortable with, and you know, some of the language, some of the situations, and finally they just said they turned it off because they said that it was negatively influencing them. And when we talk about being in the world and not of the world, you know, that there's always that tension of what does that really mean. For instance, you know, we had to go. If you go to the Lancaster, Pennsylvania, you see a lot of Amish there, and the Amish have decided to be in the world, not of the world, means to actually kind of separate yourself. You know, they still have the horse and buggies. They don't have electricity in their homes. You know, so they don't. They show that they're completely separated. Now, over the last 20, 30 years, that's eroded a little bit. When Lisa's parents had a little cabin in upstate New York, there was an Amish community near them that they were called Car Amish. You ever hear of that? That meant that they owned one car in the whole village, and they had one driver, and that was his job. What a cushy job is that? You know, right? He just drove everybody around. Then one of the other Amish guys who owned a lumber yard also owned a ski boat because he loved to go water skiing. But he would never drive the boat. So he would always make friends who would drive the boat, and he'd go out. I don't know what he wore. I would really like to know what that looked like. And now you'll see that there are some Amish that are on Facebook, but I think they call it Graven Image Book or something. I don't know. But that's, you know, that they're starting to get on that. So there's some erosion there, but there's always that thing. What does it mean to be in the world but not of the world? And so this fellow, Warren Wallace, he wrote this. He says, in the world, it's our point of location. It's our GPS. It's where we are. Just like on your phone, on your GPS, you push the little button, it shows you where you are. And he writes this, Paul was right when he said that we would have to leave the world altogether if we wanted to truly separate ourselves from immoral worldly people. That's not what God is asking us to do. The fact that you might be in a location where your Christian worldview is being challenged is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, God may have placed you there so you can have a positive impact on those who don't know Jesus, or at least learn more about the culture so that you can influence it later. And I just have to be honest, most of the time as Christ followers, I hear, you know, I'm in this terrible thing, the people are just, they're rude around me, I got to get out of there. Instead of like, they're rude around me, they're pagans, I need to influence them for Christ. See, that's the attitude. And then he goes on, and of the world, it's a source of information, or what I would also say is values. And he goes on and he says this, my concern was simply that the repeated exposure to the worldview expressed in the show was having an impact on my worldview as a Christian. It was starting to change the way I think. That isn't always the case for me, but there are definitely times when I've caught myself repeating some objectionable phrase or embracing some ungodly concept simply because I heard or saw it repeatedly in some movie, cable show, or series of conversations at work. Now you think about that and you watch television. I'm sure if you're like in my house, we'd say, then why did they put a relationship like that on there? They didn't need that. That has nothing to do with the story. Why did they use that word? They use that word all the time. There is no need to use that word in every single sentence multiple times. Why do they always picture Christians like that? Why do they always do this? And you find yourself talking about that, but what happens is they repeat it, repeat it, repeat it. Why? Because the repetition of that starts to influence you. It starts to influence culture. So he says when you start recognizing that you're starting to go, well, you know, maybe that relationship is okay, or well, you know, at least they're happy, then there's a problem. He says it's one thing to be located in these environments. It's another thing to draw from them as a source of information and behavior. And he goes on and he says, and I'm less concerned with my point of location than I am with my source of information. I often place myself in locations where non-Christian cultural worldviews are strong. My career choice forces me into situations that are challenging, and I am still cautious and adventurous enough to choose locations that are unfriendly to Christianity. I step away only when I recognize the environment is starting to change the way I think. I back off when I realize my point of location has become my source of information. And that is what we need to be cautious of. That is what we need to teach our young people. When you are around certain people and friends and in situations that are actually changing your values from a biblical value into a worldly value, that's when you need to pull back. That's when you need to separate yourself. And we need to demonstrate that too, because we're not unacceptable to having that happen to us. So being in the world is our location, but of the world is not that. We are of Jesus Christ. And so we see this at play, and we'll see this more and more as we go through the book of Esther. But here's the big lesson too that I wanted us just to kind of have a walk away with. If God can use Esther and Mordecai with their shortcomings, he certainly can use us too. I think that's the beauty of why Esther is in the Bible, to show us that even though she did some things that we don't quite understand, and maybe she should have maybe had a little stronger faith at the beginning of her life anyway, we would also say, have there been times in our lives that we weren't very strong in our faith? Maybe we've allowed our fear to kind of take over, or maybe we've allowed the world influence a viewpoint. Maybe we've allowed our own selfishness to kind of steer us away. That doesn't mean that God is done with us. It doesn't mean that God won't use us. That God still will use us. And uses in ways of impact on people's lives. But we have to be willing to be in the world and not of the world. We need to be able to recognize those patterns in our lives that are taking us away and leading us further from the truth of the gospel.